Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today's guest is Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. The Maine Council on Aging is a multidisciplinary network of 140 businesses and community members working to ensure we can all live healthy, engaged, and secure lives as we age. She's a leader in the efforts to implement policy changes on issues related to ageism, equity, poverty, housing, transportation, employment, and care. Quite a list. And Jess Maurer co-designed the Leadership Exchange on Ageism, an innovative program which has inspired over 200 leaders to take meaningful action on ageism with the goal of ending ageism in Maine. As an attorney, Jess Maurer worked for 17 years in the Maine Office of the Attorney General, where she dealt with many legislative and public outreach initiatives on a range of issues, including domestic and sexual violence, elder abuse, early care and education, and much, much more. This is just a quick snapshot of the extensive public service which Jess Maurer has been engaged in over the years here in Maine. Today, she's here to talk to us all about the Maine Council on Aging. So welcome to Healthy Options, Jess Maurer. We're glad you could take the time to speak with us today from your busy schedule.
Oh, I'm so very glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So that was quite an overview. Tell us a little bit more, just to set the stage about what the Maine Council on Aging is about with this topic of aging.
Sure. The whole idea really is that we want to live, right? We want to live our very best lives right up until the very end. And in order to be able to do that, sometimes we need to have some new systems. I think one of the things we talk about a lot. So first of all, I should back up and say we're a policy and advocacy shop. So we don't do direct service. I think it's important to say that right out loud. But what we're trying to do is change systems to support, right, the ability for us all to live healthy, engaged, secure lives as we age in our homes and community settings. And I'm a pretty practical thinker. So we're living 30 years longer than we used to. And so our systems that always worked for us individually and collectively don't always work for us anymore when we're 80 or 90 or 100. And of course, the single passenger vehicle would be the quintessential example of what works until it doesn't work. And about 93% of the people over the age of 60 in Maine have a driver's license, but only 73% of the people over 80 have a driver's license. And so as we're living longer and more people can't drive, how are we going to make sure that they gain access to all of the things they need? And so, you know, that includes, right, basic groceries and socialization and medical care and all of those things with a state that is the most rural state in the country that has really significant challenges with public transit options. And so how do we begin to think differently about transportation and how we solve for the people who need help now? And then how do we think differently in a bigger way to change our systems of transportation? So that's the kind of thing we do. It's just one little example.
So you're also working with equity and health and power and aging. Tell us more about some of those projects and how that's impacting our lives here in Maine.
Sure. So 2020 was a pivotal year for many of us for many different reasons. And I always like to say that ageism hit us over the head like a 2x4 when COVID hit. And when we started hearing national leaders say things like older people would be happy to die so that we could reopen the economy for their grandchildren, we said, wait a minute. we have a problem here, a serious and significant problem. And you know, to put that in context, a Westbrook city councilor wrote on Drew Gittin's Facebook page that we shouldn't count the deaths of older people in nursing homes because they were only waiting to die. And so, yeah, so we said, okay, oh, it's really, and this was early on in COVID. So this was round about May. We were saying, we have to get really serious about addressing ageism in Maine. And then George Floyd was murdered. It became, right, a Black Lives Matter issue. And we, as an organization, had already been doing pretty well on equity until that happened. And I said, okay, well, we're really not doing pretty well on equity. We need to think differently about the way we are doing advocacy as an organization and making sure that we are intentional. So I think that's the big difference, right? And that's the important piece with equity, that we are intentionally advocating for older people of color, older LGBT folks, older people with disabilities, older women who have had a significantly different experience than older men. And so, and as you just heard me tell that story about transportation, also what we say, we talk about disaggregating data, critically important, not just talking about all older people like this big homogenous group that has one sort of set of needs, but really saying there is a big difference between a 60-year-old, an 80-year-old, and a 100-year-old. And those folks in different age categories have different needs. And so we really said, I would say 2020, 2021 became a time of reflection and action for us. And so we knew from the Frameworks Institute, which is a national think tank that helps nonprofits think about messaging around very important issues. They had done a 3-year, actually, empirical research on what Americans think about aging and older people. And so we had their really good information that told us that Americans didn't believe that ageism was real. And if it was real, it wasn't as bad as other forms of bias. But we also knew from them is that if you help somebody understand what ageism is and the impact it has, that a light bulb goes off and they're less likely to engage in ageist behavior themselves. They're more aware, just talking about it, by the way. And they're more likely to have support for systemic changes that are needed to support healthy aging. That's where the Power in Aging program was born, right there with that research.
So let's break that down a little. There's so much there. Aging and healthcare. What ageism in healthcare? You know what are did, are you? I mean, I could talk about this, you know, but yeah. That's why you're here.
Yeah, sure. I was recently talking to 100+ volunteers at Opportunity Alliance who are foster grandparents and senior companion program volunteers. And I told them we are just about to embark on a 2-year program to reduce ageism in healthcare. And I said, I bet that's never been anything you've experienced. And there was an audible groan that was so loud, it actually surprised me at how many older people have experienced ageism in healthcare. And for the first time ever, just in 2019, AARP did a study on the cost of ageism in healthcare, and it literally costs our country billions of dollars. And people, when I've said that to some people who are really smart, they're like, "Well, what does that mean?" Well, it's about the fact that A, we don't have healthcare providers and practitioners who are trained to take care of older people. And so ridiculously, and I mean this, you know, this is not a big jump. No training. I don't know how to take care of older people. So I'm stuck with the norms that I have been raised with around aging. And so I say to people when they're in my office, well, that's just normal aging. memory loss, normal aging, that's normal. Well, I've had memory loss doctors, right? Geriatricians say to me, there is no such thing as normal memory loss. If you have real memory loss, then you have a problem, right? And that we all forget things. There's a difference between forgetfulness and memory loss. So this is what we see, is we see people's actual ailments that are treatable, right? Not being diagnosed, whether that's pain, right? Whether it's a chronic condition. I just heard about a 94-year-old who has had a chronic condition for a long time. She needs to have blood transfusions. All of a sudden, she's having to have blood transfusions way more regularly. She goes to her general practitioner who she's been with for a long time. And he said, well, you know, you are 94. Okay, well, this is a chronic condition and it changed. And there's no exploration about why it's changed. It's just, come on, you've lived long enough, right? Well, this person in particular is someone who is very important in her community. And if she died, it would be a big deal, right? But we have this idea about who people are. We don't see them anything except for a number. And so there's undertreatment, right? Well, you are 94, or that's normal aging, or there's overtreatment, right? So, oh, you've got aches and pains. Here, take this drug. We're not going to look into whether there's drug interactions. That's the number one reason that older people go to the emergency room, is what's called polypharmacy, but some sort of bad drug interaction. And it's totally avoidable, right? And our systems are built. We take people's drugs away from them when they come into the hospital. We give them new drugs or replacement drugs in the hospital. And then we send them home with them. So they have a big bag of drugs at home and a big bag of drugs from the hospital. And we're surprised when they go back to the hospital with a bad drug interaction. So this is all ageism in healthcare, and there's much, much more to it. But it's really a significant challenge that we need to, and there are really good interventions, by the way, and solutions to ageism in healthcare. It's costing us all a lot of money, and we're losing people we shouldn't be losing, including workers. From our workforce at a time when we really can't afford to lose any workers.
So, I want to invite people who are listening to listen to the archived Healthy Options program, because we've been doing a series on healthy aging. And there's something called the Beers list, B-E-E-R-S, which is a very, very comprehensive list of medications that people over 65, different metabolisms and such, metabolize differently or shouldn't take, that are very common when you're 45 or something younger. So I want to refer people to the shows that talk about that, but also the BERS and geriatricians, of course. If we can get more people trained to really understand this, that would be helpful. If you just tuned in, by the way, just want to do a little business here. I'm Rhonda Fineman. This is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. We're talking about all things anti-ageism. What does that mean? Oh my goodness. Okay. Where did that come from? Okay. We are actually talking about how that's inculcated into our culture. Now, when we're talking about healthcare, there's a gender piece that comes in. Older women are often not listened to, perhaps a little bit more than men, but still that as that kind of group, men, women, that's happening, that people are not getting the treatment that they need.
Well, I think it's a big word, but it's an important word. And I like to believe that we can all learn new things. It's a concept called intersectionality, which means that if you are a Black woman, your experiences, as a matter of fact, I'll give you real data, right? So we did a report on the economic status of older women in Maine that catalogs what happens when you experience a lifetime of economic injustices and disparities. And I could certainly go and talk a lot about that. But the reality is that women in Maine are two times more likely over 80 to live in poverty than men. Okay, so there's a data point. So that if you look at the national data, though, women is very consistently have a poverty rate two times that of older women, have a poverty rate two times that of older men, but older women of color have almost a doubling effect over white women. And so, right, so there you have what women generally have less resources, have fewer resources later in life. And then if you add just race on top of that, or sexual orientation on top of that, or disability on top of that, it's a doubling, tripling, quadrupling impact that you necessarily, it's not necessarily, but you are more likely to have fewer resources, have experienced more challenges, and may really have a strong distrust of healthcare in particular. Black women, there was a theory that Black women didn't experience pain, right? And experienced horrible discrimination in healthcare. And so if you are experiencing, you may really put off. And by the way, for sure, trans women in particular, I've just apparently stuck on women for right now.
People who are
being told all across this country, right, that they shouldn't have rights, right, that they're an abomination, and so you're already afraid to experience healthcare because of this other feature that you have, and now you're older, and so it takes you a lot to go to the doctor, and then your problems dismissed out of hand as normal aging. You don't have a memory loss problem. You don't have dementia. This is just normal aging. Well, that's really, it's horrible for the person, but can also be really impactful for the family as well,
yes.
Right? Who's tried and tried and tried to get their mother, for instance, to go to the doctor to get a diagnosis so that she could get treatment. She might be able to gain access to other supports and services. They might be able to gain access to supports and services, and boom, you're dismissed.
Right.
Right.
And it's not just dementia.
It's everything.
Well, if you're not getting tested there, I know that colonoscopies, for instance, are not being recommended for people, men or women or whomever, over a certain age. And I can give you a number of examples of people who died of colon cancer who were in their 80s, very vibrant individuals who would have benefited from that. Right. And it becomes, you've aged out. You don't need a pap smear. You don't need this. And this idea of being dismissed. You have headaches or you have this. Well, here, take an aspirin. When it turns out that you have some serious genetic thing or serious tumor or something of that ilk. And that, again, on the healthcare basis is front is why we definitely need more geriatricians and people who can specialize in this and understand what is healthy aging. If you are below the poverty level or you don't have a lot of finances, you're not going to be eating as well. And that will be part of, you won't necessarily, maybe you are, but there is a possibility that you won't be able to afford some of the things that would be helpful to keep you healthy and vibrant.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go back, though, before
you
leave. You've said it twice now. The reality is, and I'm not speaking out of turn, this is well documented.
Go for it.
There are not enough doctors in the country, even if they all shifted to be geriatricians, to meet the demand that is coming our way because we're living 30 years longer. And this is a big part of it, right, is that that's not even something people have intellectualized. And I think, and I mean anybody, I don't just mean some people. I mean, like, your average citizen, whether they're a doctor or a nurse or a laborer, doesn't know we've gained 30 new years, right? And so if you're making a judgment, right, about a colonoscopy, for instance, at a 65-year-old, that's really based on this idea that you're going to live, your expected life is 76. And no, you're probably not going to get colon cancer and die before that. Okay, that's, it's all a logarithm, right? But the reality is you could have lived to 106. And that decision at 65 really cut somebody's life short. And what could they have done? Who were they? How were they important to our economy, our community, our arts community, our engineering community? I mean, our schools, right? Our grandchildren. I mean, these are the questions. And so I just want to say the deal is, it's not about getting people to specialize. And we do need more. We need many, many more people to specialize. And that's about incentivizing. You know, you're going to choose, geriatrician is the dead last if you look at, mm-hmm. yeah, the dead last, because it's not, there's no money in it.
It's not right? lucrative.
So it's all about, when you go, medical school is wildly expensive. And so what you want to do is get out and earn enough money at least to pay your student debts, right? And you're not going to if you're going to be a geriatrician. So you're going to become a pediatrician, or you're going to specialize. You're going to be, whatever the specialist is of the day, you're going to be that instead of, right, a geriatrician. What we need to do, and Dartmouth Hitchcock, by the way, is a real leader in this area, is thinking about how do we, in a very meaningful way, say what good geriatric care is at a primary care level, and how do we help primary care practices effectively manage their older patient population in a way that ultimately generates money for them if they are actively doing it. We did that with diabetes 15 years ago with patient-centered medical homes, right? We said, do you know you could actually do a better, have better patient health and actually bring money into your practice if you managed your patient population with diabetes, right? So this is the exact same thing. It's like saying, you're leaving money on the table, primary care practice, if you don't understand how to effectively manage the older patient population and keep them healthy. And so there's lots that need to be done on that front. So I'll shift back to your other question, which is really around social health needs, right? And the people, and this is a big equity issue. So if you, for instance, are a woman who experienced a lifetime of economic disadvantage and you are living alone, in Maine, half of the older women who live alone don't have enough money to meet their basic needs. This is really important. And so you do exactly that. You have two meals a day instead of three, or sometimes one meal a day. You only take your prescription drugs every other day, or you cut your pills in half. You keep your house at 50 degrees in a very uncomfortable way. You do not have enough money to modify your home to be safe, or to fix significant problems with your home that come up. You certainly can't pay for care, right? Home care, if you need it. And that's, a big challenge, is that older women are two times more likely to live alone than older men in Maine. And you don't have built-in everything, right? You don't have another income. You don't have built-in supports for informal caregiving. You don't have somebody who can drive you to the grocery store. You don't have somebody who can put your air conditioner in if you can't, right? All of these things then become things you have to pay for if you need them. And so it's a significant challenge, and we've actually done something about it. So all of those things are
what have we done?
So we, because we have done this report on the economic status of older women, and we've done considerable research nationally, because it's not good data, locally on the impacts of racism and homophobia and transphobia and ableism, nationally, there's good data. We have some good data here in Maine around ableism, actually, and the number of people with disabilities who are unable to be employed or are unemployed as opposed to able-bodied people. But what we know are all of those things result in people being more likely to have fewer resources later in life. And so what we did was looked at how do we increase income, right, for these people who have experienced a lifetime of economic disparities. We went to the legislature and we said, would you please increase eligibility for the Medicare Savings Program? And the Medicare Savings Program is a federal health care program that pays for Medicare Part B, Medicare Part D, provides extra help. And so it's a value of about $7,500 for everybody, anybody who's on the program. So 100% of the people will get their Medicare Part B program paid for, which is about $2,100. So then that's paid.
That's huge.
It automatically comes out of your Social Security, right? And so we use what's called the Elder Economic Security Index. If you've never heard of it, it's important to hear about. It's been around for about 25 years, and it looks at nationally by county what an older person needs to have for income just to meet their basic needs. And so we told a story. And the nice thing about you should check it out. You should actually share the link with your listeners. So the Elder Economic Security Index, you put in your state or your county, but then you can say, do you live alone or in a couple? Is your health good, excellent, or poor? And do you live in housing, a house you own with a mortgage, or do you rent? And you can put in these multiple factors and it tells you how much your earnings need to be to meet your basic needs. And so we went to the legislature looking at a person living alone in poor health in a home that they own with a mortgage, because that tells a story for us, right? That's a woman who has experience, because they're women, older women have significantly higher disability rates than older men. Because I like to say women's work is hard work. And so your body breaks down a little bit faster than older men. And so we went to the legislature and we said, well, this is what we think the eligibility limits should be. And this is why. And they agreed 100%. We got a unanimous agreement on that. And so that was supposed to take effect in March. The Mills administration, for some reason, chose to try to repeal that. But we fought that over this legislative session and won again. So it has taken effect on July 1st. And so 45,000 Mainers are newly eligible for this benefit. Older Mainers are newly eligible for this benefit that literally will save them about $7,500 a year,
that's extraordinary. Extraordinary. Yeah. That is totally a game changer. If you just tuned in, we are speaking with Jess Maurer, who's the executive director of the Maine Council on Aging, and we're learning all about the programs and how poverty and all of these intersectionality of the human experience can affect us as we age. And we're here at Healthy Options on WERU. So I want to talk about some of the language. I want to talk about how we speak. We're going backwards. How do we speak about aging? What is ageism? What is the language, and how does that affect what we think and stereotypes and
well, yeah, those are some interesting things, right? So ageism, of course, is incorrect. You know, they're not correct. They're not based in reality. Assumptions and stereotypes about older people. And I always like to say, we're all ageist, and that ageism is against our older self, right?
We are all aging.
We're all aging, right? So that's the first problem, right? Is that we talk about aging like it's a problem. And the thing is we're all aging. It is a process. Aging is a process. It starts when we're born, it ends when we're dead, and everything we're doing in the middle is aging, right? So we have made aging synonymous with old. And we need to decouple that concept. And we're just as guilty, by the way, Tracy Gendron said, you know, that's the problem. And I was like, oh, geez, we have to change our name, but we haven't quite got there yet. I mean, Council on Aging, right? Exactly, right? So I like to call myself out. I mean, so I get to, I'll tell you this stuff that the Frameworks Institute found. And I'll tell you, we went back and we reframed, is what it's called, reframed our own mission, vision, and goals, and couldn't even believe how bad they were. So, I mean, like, again, you know, like, and we're very thoughtful. This is what we do for work. And so you can learn, right? You're doing fine just the way they are, but you could be better. So you get new tools, you do new stuff, right? So the Frameworks Institute found a bunch of things, but one of the things they did was literally just ask people words, right? So when you hear these words, senior, senior citizen, elder, older person, older, you know, adult, is this person, which one's the oldest? And which one's the most competent and the least competent? And it, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all that that Americans, this is just generic Americans, right, typically find the word senior, senior citizen, even elder, to be associated with the oldest among us and the least competent. And they see the words older people, older person as younger and more competent. So a lot of things have happened just around that little body of research. And so there's a national organization, the Gerontological Society of America, that has taken over sort of the Reframing Aging initiative nationally. And they worked with the Associated Press and the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association, all of whom have changed their recommendations related to language. And I really like the Associated Press one because they're, of course, go with, we should always be calling people what they want to be called, right? So I always say this is sort of a little bit of a red herring talking about language, because you'll always find somebody in every crowd who says, I love being called senior. I earned it. And I'm like, good on you. That's great. But the reality is, when you say senior, the person next to you thinks, the person next to you, by the way, who's 75, thinks the senior is their 95-year-old mother. And I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time. When we talk to 75-year-olds and we say, what's old and when will you be old? They're talking about their elderly parents. Okay. So it's about being specific, right? That's why I'm like all about calling out organizations, and particularly the press, right? So the press talks about affordable senior housing. And so I'll like go right to them. I'm like, well, what is that? Did you happen to know that that's for people 55 and over? Do you think people who are 55 think they're seniors? Do they think that housing is for them? Like, we have to change the way we talk to be specific as providers, right? If we want to make sure we're being effective at saying this thing I'm talking about, right, the Medicare Savings Program, at least there's some specificity on that, because you have to be on Medicare to get the program and you have to be at least 65 to get Medicare, right? So at least we have a sense of that. But if we're talking about just this is for seniors, I always say, well, who's that? Who are you talking about? Because I don't know what that word means.
But also breaking down what is the assumption. What right. is this? What does that mean? So you have a wonderful brochure here about power in aging, and there's this great diagram, and it says, "What do we think when we say elder?" And it's talking about a burden, fearful, right. set in their ways, decline is inevitable, versus experience, masterful, expertise, love, right. diverse, positive. Right. Teachers, elders, in a sense of learning from and experiencing in a positive way. So we have to even go beyond what the quote the word is. It's like what is the image that we That's associate right. with it?
Yeah, and this goes to the cultural piece exactly, and gets us right back to ageism and healthcare, which is that we end where I started. So this idea that we have made aging synonymous with old, and old is synonymous with decline. And that is just the way it is. And so, and really only decline. So we don't lift up all of those other great words you just referenced. And honestly, you know, it's top of mind. We ask those, the sort of the negative view, we ask groups of people wherever we go to do that. We ask them, you know, what are the words that you think about when, you know, the stereotypes, norms of beliefs that we have about aging and older people. And the words 99% of the time are negative. And people are actually really shocked when they see it and they hear it, and it's fast. You can do that in a minute. You can make a word cloud, and it's, I mean, except for the word wise, which comes up again, which is, by the way, also a stereotype. Not every older person is wise, believe it or not. But all older people have accumulated knowledge, right? They have had experiences that, you know, what wisdom would say is they learn from those accumulated experiences. Not everyone has, right? I mean, this is the human condition, but most of us have. And so we do have this growing capacity that comes along with getting older, growing knowledge, right? And so we don't tend to think about all of the positives that come along with being older. And yeah, I always like to say when I hit 50, I stopped caring about what anybody thought of me. And I wouldn't have believed that was going to happen, but that was, I mean, what a cool thing to have happen. And all my friends were the same. And everybody was like, we don't care anymore.
Well, like, 50, yes. Some people wait till they're 56. I just thought I'd throw that out there. Yeah. You know, you're really advanced in your positive outlook there. You know, that's the other aspect of the positive is what people say to themselves. Right. Or I'm having a senior moment. In a negative way. I can't do that anymore because I'm 65. Not because I can't do it because of some reason, but we shouldn't be doing that because I'm some random number that's not 40 or 30 or 20 anymore. You know, so how we talk to ourselves as well. And so what is that?
That's also, though, a cultural thing. I think about this all the time. I mean, I've known this phrase since I was very young. You can't teach an old dog a new trick. Right. I mean, that's a phrase that we get indoctrinated to very early. Very early on. And certainly this idea of retirement, right, is also good for no one in that sense of, you know, we it's like you drop off a cliff, right? The way we've set up the system, right, you're working until the end of, you know, you're at the very top of your game when you get done and you retire and then boom, you're gone, right? So it's a very interesting phenomenon that we've created, and it's a very cultural thing, and we repeat it. That's the thing, is we hear it and we repeat it. So the senior moment thing, it's one of my pet peeves, and I'll tell you a story about it because I love this story so much. But I just also think people need to hear some facts, right? So we have a high rate of dementia and Alzheimer's in this country. About 13% of us will have some sort of cognitive decline. All right. 87% of us won't.
Right.
The vast majority of us will never have a memory problem. And it's one of those things we're all terrified of. I mean, we have to admit this. We need to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely.
I am terrified. We're all terrified of getting dementia. We know how horrible it is. Right. We're all terrified about getting cancer, too. But we don't make jokes about it. Right. I mean, there's no cancer moment. Right. So like the senior moment thing is reinforcing this idea, this fear in us that it is inevitable. It's inevitable that you're going to lose your memory, right? Inevitable. 13% of us will. The vast majority of us won't. So the guy who runs our leadership exchange on ageism, he's mid-70s. I'm not going to say how exactly old he is. He would, though. And he's got this great story. He was like in his 30s. He was in a meeting in Portland. He worked for an organization in Portland. And this guy said, "Would you give me a ride home? My car's in the shop." And he said, "Sure, no problem." He got home and he was like, "Oh my God, I'm such an idiot. I forgot to take, you know, Steve home." And that was a horrible thing, right? It was a big memory loss thing. So fast forward, and he's in his mid-60s, and he's in a meeting in Portland, and he comes out, and he can't find his car anywhere. And what's going through his head is, it's happening. I'm getting dementia, right? It's actually happening. So in 30s, you know, he forgets to take his friend home, and he's an idiot. You know, and he's 65, and it's inevitable that he's actually going to get dementia. But his car is towed.
I was just going to say, this is me. I was going to say, and his car was really stolen. It had nothing to do with his.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I went. Exactly.
Yeah. So this is the thing, is like, we're feeding the monster. We're feeding the monster ourselves, but culturally we feed that monster too. And we really need to do a better job because I think you're trying to get at this. And I think if there's nothing, right? And I know you've had other folks on the show to talk about this, but, you know, if you live with age positive views, right, if you resist this idea that your old age is going to be terrible and filled with nothing but disease and decline, right, if you resist that and you instead believe that you're going to continue to live, as I said, right, your very best life up until the end, you're going to live 7.5 years longer with fewer chronic conditions, better brain health, less anxiety and depression. You're going to actually heal faster and you're going to be happier. I don't know anybody who doesn't want to sign up for that program.
Positive. Yeah. Positive program. Let's just take that in, everybody. Take a breath. Positive. Resilient. And from a lot of the research, even people who actually have chronic conditions or have some physical or medical issue, with the attitude idea, they are still doing well. I mean, not everyone, of course, and let's not minimize the idea of pain and suffering, but the idea overall for many is that that even with living with whatever, that one can be social and still interact in a vibrant way.
Well, and so, you know, let's unpack this idea just a tiny little bit, because, by the way, our public health system needs to catch up to this, for a long time, their theory, right? I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. This is a big national issue. And I think even internationally, like people haven't known in public health, which is prevention, haven't known what to do about aging, i.e. getting old, because you can't prevent it. Right. I've even heard that with dementia, you know, well, you can't prevent them. Well, you know what? Now we pretty much think we probably can at least put it off a lot. So the key here is that understanding now that change, shifting our thinking, that shifting our culture to one of, you know, this, all of those negative words you said, right, that's top of mind about aging. If we shift that to the positive, we will have a healthier population that lives longer, more engaged lives. What are the keys, though? The keys are purpose, inclusion, and belonging. And those are important.
Say that again.
Purpose, inclusion, and belonging. Okay. Purpose, inclusion, and belonging. Purpose is just the reason to get up in the morning. But we talk to Maine employers everywhere, and we hear about intentional age discrimination everywhere in relation to ageism and employment. And older people have a really hard time maintaining employment in Maine, some older people, not all older people. So that's a real challenge that we are going to need to figure out how to overcome. But also older people, particularly people who've had to work 2 or 3 or 4 jobs, right, just to keep up, Some of them have, but a lot of them haven't had a culture of volunteering, and by the way, are also exhausted. But understanding that making sure people have purpose in their life, and that can just be taking care of your grandkid, right? That's a big deal.
That's huge. Right?
So that's a huge deal. It's a huge deal for your family. It's a huge deal for you. But understanding that doing nothing is really not that good for you. Like, you really need to have a purpose to be able to maintain that good health we're talking about. But let's say your purpose is volunteering, right? And you, and as I mentioned earlier about the fact that when you're 80 and over, you're more likely to have challenges with driving, maintaining your driver's license, or you know, being able to drive yourself. And so all of a sudden, your purpose, if your purpose involves driving, might be eliminated. And that's where inclusion and belonging becomes so important. Like, we have to be thinking differently about people who can't drive. Right. And particularly as it relates to purpose, we need to be creating pathways to purpose for people who now are potentially homebound, and for any reason, for any number of reasons. Right. That could be a health homebound, or it could just be I can't drive, or maybe I can't see. Right. These are all, you know, pieces that happen. It doesn't mean my brain doesn't work. Doesn't mean that I can't be useful, but I need organizations to say, I need you to help us. Right? This Medicare savings program I was just talking about, helping people gain access to Medicare or understand Medicare is wildly complicated. I mean, not the Medicare savings program, that's easy, but Medicare itself is wildly complicated. The people who are Medicare volunteers, they do like 40 hours of training to become Medicare. Well, you can do that from home, right? You can be a friendly visitor from home. You can check on your neighbor from home, right? There's all kinds of things that you could do from home, but we haven't really kind of built that. And what about engaging in civic, right? Civic leadership, or even just civic activities. If I can't drive and there's no public transit or no transit options for me to go to the town meeting, I can no longer go to the town meeting or sometimes vote. And so, you know, our systems haven't caught up with our longevity, and we haven't integrated this idea that purpose, inclusion, and belonging are things we need to really be thoughtful about, intentional about, as we design what's next.
That's really, really, really important, really important to take in. So drive your neighbor to the grocery store.
Right.
Drive your neighbor to a doctor's appointment if you can. Figure out if you're able, how can you plug in? And that will not only be nice for your neighbor, but it would be nice for you.
Right. And
we know so much about how social interaction is so important for our mental health and our physical health. All of these are connected. We can't separate it. That if we're moving to the best of our ability, even exercise, people, there's chair yoga, there's ways to move within your ability. Of this is really possible. Oh, by the way, if you have just tuned in, we are speaking with Jess Maurer, who is the executive director of the Maine Council on Aging. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and you're tuned to the Healthy Options program on WERU Community Radio. We are going through quite a lot of information about what it means to age well, and how is the society and how is the systems can catch up with that. Tell me more about that leadership program that you developed. You've mentioned it a few times. What exactly is that?
So the Leadership Exchange on Ageism is for leaders, we define that pretty broadly. So that could be a CEO or a legislator or a commissioner or a person who's leading in a lifelong community initiative or a volunteer initiative in their community, or somebody on a board or that. I mean, you know, we define it pretty broadly. And the idea is to spend, it's a 14-hour course, and it's broken down into four sessions. It's all virtual. And we look at internal ageism, interpersonal ageism between you and I, and institutional ageism and systemic ageism. And the course is a little bit didactic, but mostly it's case study. So we have a number of case studies that help folks work through initiatives. There's a lot of reading and videos people watch, but mostly it's conversation, and we call it pair shares. So there's a lot of reflection, and pair shares has a lot of focus on equity as well and intersectionality. So we're helping people think about how they, right, how they are, you know, sort of thinking about aging and about older people, and then thinking, so that's, you know, that's the internal, and then thinking about their workplace and how there might be institutional bias against older people. And that could be, and we have, and, you know, we have, and by the way, the program has recommendations, significant recommendations in relation to what you can do about things. And so, for instance, obviously, there's some basic stuff, right? You can train your HR director, not ask questions about age on your applications. It's around culture. We've talked about culture. Be set expectations about people not using language like dinosaur, right? or and also looking at, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at the visual piece too, which is look at your website and I want to be a multi-generational employer. Well, let's look at your advertising. Do you actually show pictures of older people doing meaningful, you know, work in your institution? Are you portraying older people as a stereotype, right? Do you have an older person sitting in a wheelchair with a direct care worker's hand on that person's shoulder as the only image you have on your, or, you know, a shopper being, you know, using a walker being helped by someone? You know, what's the image that you are generating? And by the way, it goes both ways. We talk about the super ager, right? When I first learned about the reframing aging research, I said, well, wait a minute, let me guess. People are either out golfing or in their sailboat or they're dead. And then the head of Frameworks Institute said, well, you got it right away, because that's what I hear, right? So the other thing is that people have this idea that older people are all living like a life of leisure, and that it's easy for them and they have plenty of resources. I don't know where they got these resources.
Lots of money.
Exactly. So, you know, really looking at the images of your organization, many other things. And then the last is really looking at systemic ageism and how our systems are biased in relation to and what we call youth privilege, and that we are much more likely. And we actually, again, have case scenarios. And you know, you mentioned I worked in interpersonal violence a little bit in my past. And if you look at the amount of money spent federally on child abuse and neglect versus interpersonal violence, adults, right? Domestic violence is what it would be just typically called. And then elder abuse. And, you know, we have this great slide. Nationally, basically, the population 0 to 17 and the population over 65 is almost exactly the same. And the amount spent on elder abuse is this tiny little bit of the amount of child abuse, you know, is huge amount.
Wow.
And, you know, so the questions are, what's going on here, right? What are the assumptions, the stereotypes, the messages? That's what we really do. This class is really about creating a framework to unpack what you're seeing, what you're hearing, right? What you're experiencing in systems, in your institutions, in your in your personal life. What are the ways and how can you analyze it? That's really what this class helps you do. And then how can you, so we say, you know, sort of you see it and then you name it and then you you correct it basically. You know, you redirect it so that, or disrupt it. We like the word disrupt.
Disrupt.
Go ahead.
No, yes. This idea of abuse not being registered. So there has to be a lot of training for the medical staff to notice if someone's being influenced, bankers, or is somebody trying to take somebody's money? Is there someone, is it too good to be true? the person who's too good to be true. Community awareness of what's happening with our older population. Are they isolated? Are they not being able to go to the meetings they used to go to because someone's intervening? Those are warning signals. We would perhaps in an educated community know that about children or possibly, hopefully, but that's something that we're not talking about enough, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's we are not talking about elder abuse enough. That absolutely is true, and you know, ageism is a huge driver in all this, right? Because there's this idea. So a lot of what we do with the Leadership Exchange on Ageism is to help people understand this very important piece, right? Throughout this entire conversation, I've been talking to you about facts. I've been talking to you about systems that have resulted in the outcomes that those systems have been designed to, right? And so we Americans really have pledged allegiance to this idea of independence and self-agency, right? And so we're like, if an older person is signing away all their money, it's their fault. They're just a stupid person, right? And so we don't have capacity, right? Or they don't have enough money to modify their homes, right? Well, so again, I could tell you the story of a woman, right? I mean, I like to just say, right? It was 1974. I was 8 when I got the right to have a credit card in my name, to have a bank account in my name, and to hold a mortgage, right? I mean, 1974, that was not that long ago. So, right. So if you're looking at somebody, a 75-year-old woman who, had a very difficult time working when she was younger, was expected to have kids, entered the workforce late, got paid less than men, had to leave the workforce to take care of aging relatives, didn't pay into Social Security during that time, didn't have any retirement savings, got divorced. Divorce is a big thing, you know, lost a bunch of her property, and now lives alone, right? Those are systemic things. And then we say, she didn't work hard enough, right? I mean, we have real judgment. She may have real judgment. I mean, that's the thing where this is, you know, because we have these stories here about who's responsible and who's irresponsible. And so we don't look at the real systems that result in people living in poverty later in life. And we think, you know, you should have done something different. You should have saved more. You should have worked harder. You should have fill in the blank. And why should I have to? Why should I have to take care of you?
Whoa.
Right.
So this is so many layers and level here. I just want to just say one last thing, and we are running out of time. There's just so much. You'll have to come back because we could just go on and on. I do have a friend whose 106-year-old aunt just died, and her cousin is 76, and they live together. So mom is 106, and then 76-year-old is the kid. So Let's put it all in perspective here.
Anyway, it's so great.
Our guest today on Healthy Options has been Jess Maurer, Executive Director of Maine Council on Aging. Thank you so much for joining us today on Healthy Options. For the you'll have your website. We'll put that on the archives, MaineCouncilOnAging.org. And for those not in Maine, that's M-A-I-N-E, like the state. The show is information that was mentioned will be posted on the Healthy Options Archives in the Public Affairs section. I want to thank Joel Mann, Amy Brown at ERU for engineering support, and for Petra Hall for production assistance. Thank you so much, as always, to our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Fineman wishing you the best in health. Thanks for listening.